Hey everyone, welcome to episode 47 of Long Shots, our homegrown banter of sorts on all things business and finance. It's been a bit of a gap, I guess, Sharad. I was incommunicado for 2 weeks.
Yeah, we missed a week, but I spoke to myself for 1 hour.
Did you record it, man?
I forgot to record it.
Great, great.
It was a great chat, though.
Yeah, I'm sure our listeners will be, you know, crying in pain to miss your internal musings. But yeah, so it's been a bit of a gap, but lots of things have happened. When I was back from Uttarakhand,
yeah.
I spent almost a day just catching up with what our dear FM has been up to. Our dear central bank has been up to a lot of things, and obviously in the corporate world, a lot of announcements, pronouncements are coming in. And before we kind of hit all of that, would like to obviously remind our listeners that we are streaming as usual on multiple podcast apps: Deezer, Spotify, Google Podcast, iTunes. And I'm making it sound like it's a major logistical exercise. It's not, but yeah, we are available on all those platforms.
Yeah, it's optionality.
It's optionality. So yeah, of course, whatever you like, do subscribe, do search for Long Shots, and so that you get that nice notification every time an episode goes live. And with that, Sharad and Nikhil, what's the agenda today, man?
Let's keep it free flowing, but let's start with something that we were talking about earlier, especially because we try to follow the electric vehicle space. We also closely watch the ride hailing app space.
Yeah.
And we obviously like private equity interest. So when you combine all of this, you look at Uber and Ola and what's happening in the shared mobility space. So the big news was, of course, Mahindra sort of trying to pick up a 55% stake. Well, not trying. They did pick up a 55% stake in Meru Cabs. Remember that name?
Yes, I do. The friendly Meru you see at you still see at the airport.
Yeah, and in fact, one of their competitive advantages, they have like locked-in contracts with most airports.
Yeah.
So that's a big thing. But yeah, you're right. Even whenever I hear Meru Cabs, the first thing that I think about is that weird blue color and airports.
Yeah. So, but before we kind of go a bit deep dive into this, I guess we are using this as a, we'll finally use this as a segue to also comment on the wider macroeconomic situation within the country, right?
Yeah.
Auto sector, then obviously that will roll up to distressed GDP numbers, which will get rolled up to the banking crisis, and obviously the funky stuff that the RBI is doing.
Yeah.
The recent bouts of generosity that they have.
Yeah.
And anyway, so Mahindra takes 55% of Meru. How much was that for?
201.5 crores.
So yeah, roughly 400 CR valuation.
Yeah, I guess. And they did, I think, sales of about 160 crores or something. So like, okay, let's call it between 2.5 and 3 times sales.
Right. So Mahindra is primarily, it's a lot of things, right? They're an OEM. They have an NBFC, and now they have acquired, can I describe Meru as a taxi aggregator?
Or is it a radio taxi fleet provider, I guess.
Right.
And last year, they made a strategic tilt in their pricing models. So they sort of went the dynamic pricing route as well.
Okay.
They've put in some complaints to the Competition Bureau, complaining about Ola and Uber.
Right.
Clearly, they've seen their market share dwindle. And their complaint is that those guys are pricing, predatory pricing, burning vast sums of investor money entirely to distort the market. That's obviously been their complaint, and you can see where they're coming from.
But are they like similar models? Are they like also asset light?
I think they are. Right. They are similar.
Gradually kind of going in that direction.
Going in that direction. But what is true is that they are in competition with them. They are, you know, radio, they call themselves radio taxi, but they are sort of in that space. And so it's good. It's interesting that Mahindra will take 55% is like effectively buying them out, right? Like ownership and board basically are in the decision-making power now. So it makes a little bit of sense to have a heavyweight backer now. Someone who also is exploiting and toying with the electric vehicle sector.
Right.
And I think we know that Mahindra is sort of pushing big into the electric vehicle space.
Yeah.
In fact, they even renamed their Mahindra Electric division to some Mahindra Electric Mobility Solutions or something.
Right.
So clearly
groovy.
Groovy,
broad, generic name.
Yeah.
Which can include everything.
So that could sort of have a massive impact, I guess, right?
Yeah. In the electric space, I mean, you looked at it separately as well. Like having because of the weak underlying economics at the consumer level, it's always good to have the OEM as well as the distributor in the same ship.
I guess so, yeah. Internalize it, right? I mean, it's a corporate finance discussion of whether, you know, internalization versus keeping it outside. I don't know what works, but definitely more control.
Yeah.
It's an inbuilt distribution arm now.
Yeah.
It's a little bit like, I like the Netflix analogy of putting their own content and using their own distribution platform.
Right.
So Mahindra can put their own vehicles and have their own distribution platform.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it obviously makes some sense.
But why is it more important? Like, obviously, I know, but like for the benefit of the listeners, why is it more important in case of EV to have that end-to-end versus ICE?
I guess just more control, dependence on infrastructure for the smooth functioning.
Yeah. Because infra is a much bigger piece in electric, right?
Electric, yeah. I mean, and because we're at a stage where it will take time to sort of build it as robust as, let's call it, gas stations or CNG stations or whatnot, yeah. It will take a fair bit away.
Yeah.
So I guess the better control you have, the quicker you can grow.
Because I guess anyways, I mean, these aggregators, most of them, I think they started pretty much like, especially in US, they started as pure play marketplaces, right? Where anyone who has a driver's license could basically, it was like a gig thing, right? That you have a driver's license, you want to make some extra money and you kind of list your vehicle on Uber and you basically become a taxi driver overnight.
Yeah.
But in India, the evolution has been slightly different, right? I mean, in India, they have it's more intermediated.
It is more intermediate, and actually, you need a commercial license plate for it.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's the case, at least in the West. You and I, personally.
Perhaps not.
Perhaps not. Yeah. It's definitely not. I don't know about I know in North America, it's not.
Yeah.
Here, you need a commercial license for it. It is a commercial agreement.
So you have to be some sort of a taxi company.
Yeah.
Or at least a licensed taxi driver.
Yeah. You are in commercial transportation. You're no longer sort of in the West, you can just overnight sort of sign up. If you have a decent enough rare record.
So automatically it becomes asset heavy for the taxi company.
Correct.
So I guess for them, the financing of the vehicle becomes a major role. And I guess with Mahindra having an NBFC as well.
Should help. Yeah, I guess so.
They anyways are making them. And now they have the last mile distribution arm through Meru. So that might be an angle, I guess.
I guess so, yeah. And that's definitely... Mahindra themselves have been saw wider auto sector phenomenon, but they also have seen that sales slump.
Yeah.
So this might be another avenue to explore further. And you remember when we talked about, I think this was a few months back, when we talked about this service that Mahindra had launched called Glide. Which was which was like a mobility solution, premium offering.
GLYD,
correct, yes. And it was aimed, I think it started with 10 vehicles, eVeritas or whatever those vehicles are called in Mumbai.
Right.
Where they had web conferencing and state-of-the-art tech inside the vehicle. It was aimed at professionals.
Right.
So if you're going to work, you'll have air purifier and web conferencing facilities and directly connected in the vehicle.
Right.
So they were sort of toying with the idea of mobility solutions anyway.
Right.
So this is sort of a different take on it, but it's again an endorsement to towards mobility solutions, right?
But I guess the funny thing is that Ola is also now quite pushy on the electric mobility side, right? Don't they take Mahindra vehicles?
I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, and even if they don't, even if they haven't, I think when electric vehicles come through, I think they will.
Yeah.
Because Mahindra has been the front runner in the Indian ecosystem anyway.
Yeah.
But it's interesting that Hyundai and Kia
also
invested $300 million, I think, recently in Ola.
So, oh, okay.
So they are also eyeing that space. So that's another OEM sort of play, right?
Yeah.
So.
But they're probably doing it more as an investor.
I guess so. Because they themselves are toying with electric vehicles as well. So, and it's good. I think three players are a basic minimum, I think, in every space.
Yeah.
So right now, I think we were versus Uber versus Ola. If we can see Meru really pick it up, then three-player market, I think, makes more sense.
And I guess there are a lot of, in the EV space, there are a lot of fleet players.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, there are a few discrete players in each tier one city.
Yeah.
So it's only about a function of time when there is a consolidation play coming in.
Yeah.
I figure, right?
Yeah.
So, that's pretty fascinating to see how, right across the value chain within the EV domain, different guys are dabbling in.
Yeah, I'm going to be very curious on how this goes through. I like the fact that it's an Indian company with an Indian OEM.
Right. Right.
So that will be interesting. And
you are a keen follower of Mr. Anand Mahindra on Twitter as well.
Oh, yeah, I am. I like his views and pro-business narrative, very open about it. And so I like that. And
you also put, like, once in a while, you also put some, like, feel-good stuff, right?
Yeah. Yeah. No, so it's going to be interesting, but... Yeah. It's obviously comes at a time when the auto sector has been, you know, soft.
Mm.
Mahindra themselves reported a 26% decline in domestic sales in August, which is substantial. It's like a fourth, right?
Yeah.
26%. And yes, I mean, there's a part of it which is aimed towards diversification of business as well, I guess.
Yeah.
When you I don't think that ride hailing or mobility will overtake ownership of cars. I don't think it'll happen in the near future, but even if it does, it's good to sort of diversify yourself, I guess, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, auto sector is so important to the Indian ecosystem, Indian market.
At least Mahindra was not blaming the wider economy
I think,
for the 26% drop.
Yeah,
unlike, what was that, that biscuit company?
Parle
or something, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I have a feeling like a lot of the companies are kind of, you know, piggybacking on the distressed economic situation just to be answerable to their shareholders.
Yeah. And the same ones are, when they're pitching their company, they talk about how defensive their stocks are.
Yeah.
That they're recession-proof and downturn-proof. Well, then if you were defensive,
then why
are you making noise right now?
Yeah.
Take a stand. Like, you can't have both things.
So, I guess the wider auto sector in general also got off a bit of a relief in the last 2 weeks. It kind of formed a key component of the FM's economic plan, right? I mean, a bit of pressure off in terms of move towards electric vehicles, in terms of resale of old vehicles. But, I mean, before we kind of go into that, a few depressing numbers. India's GDP for Q1, June numbers, 5% year-on-year. Lowest in 6 years.
Yeah.
And
significantly below the sort of 7% number we were getting just used to.
Yes. So, I mean, the order of events was interesting, right? Because I don't know, what was it, the FM's plan which came out first, then the surplus was announced, then the bank merger plan was announced, and in between the Q1 numbers came out. Right?
Yes, I think that's what happened. Yeah.
Yeah.
And they're all sort of linked in some form or shape anyway, right? I guess.
I mean, that entire narrative of a slowing economy, that's been in place since the budget.
Yeah.
Practically. I remember markets tanked immediately after the budget.
Yeah.
A few corrective actions were taken. But I mean, if you look at it at a wider space, what has happened is that there's a consumption slowdown, right? And as a result of that, there was a supply slowdown before that.
Yeah.
And now consumption seems to have caught up with it. And
we've been talking about it for, I think, the last, I guess, 6-8 months. Like, the signs were there.
Yeah.
CapEx spending was down.
Yeah.
We knew that it will ultimately come and hit the consumer.
But yeah, spending. It's just so difficult to time it. Right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And I guess now everyone has timed it.
Yeah.
most commentators, I was just going through a few reports, right? Like Fitch, Nomura, Deutsche Bank, HSBC, like most brokers, they've all revised their full year GDP numbers down from, they were all at early 7, now they're all at early 6.
Okay, still, okay.
So they're all saying there's going to be a rebound, this is the bottom, but it's going to be a weak rebound. That's the main change that everyone has taken. But I think the government is still pretty optimistic, right? I mean, RBI is still estimating at 6.9.
Yeah.
The economic survey which came out estimated at 7. And so I guess there's a massive
turnaround in the latter half then. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a slight bit of denial there going on, right? And plus, obviously, there's that $5 trillion target, which is supposed to be achieved in the next, I don't know, 5 years, 6 years, whatever, which requires at least 9-10% growth, right? So I think that kind of seems like a bit of a theoretical exercise.
Maybe with this new consolidation in banks, maybe all of a sudden their lending book goes 10x up and all of a sudden people start buying cars. No, that's not going to happen.
Yes, that's how things work, Sharon. Yeah, you also know that very well, right?
Yeah.
In terms of, you know, what's going on, one lens I thought was an interesting way to look at this was go back in history. You know, I was recently checking out, you've heard of Irving Fisher maybe, right?
The model also by his name, Fisher Model, I think. Also.
No, that's Fisher Black.
Yeah, Black and
Scholes. This guy was, I think, in the early 20th century. His claim to fame was that he was vouched as one of the greatest American economists till the Great Depression. He personally invested a lot of money in U.S. stocks.
Yeah.
And then he lost 95% of it in the recession. He was not able to predict it.
In the Great Depression?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So that in the 30s.
Yeah.
And then he lost most of his wealth. And then the last, I think, 15 or 20 years of his life, he spent in trying to rationalize what really happened. And so he's a kind of a interesting character because, you know, his inability to predict the Great Depression pretty much ruined his financial as well as financial health as well as reputational health.
Yeah.
So as to say.
That does it. Recession has a funny habit of doing that to a lot of people, I guess.
Yeah. But like post-crisis in 30s, he said that U.S. is going through debt deflation.
Okay.
And, you know, I was just, I was pretty curious to understand what it is. So I just went to the original paper that Fisher wrote in which he said that, you know, the way the chain of events which kind of lead to debt deflation is that there's a lot of leverage in the system, right? Which leads to distressed sales, which leads to contraction of, you know, deposit currency, which leads to fall in the level of prices, and which leads to greater fall in net worth of businesses, which leads to greater fall in the profitability of businesses, which leads to reduction in output, trade, reduction in credit. And then it's a cycle.
Okay.
And when I was reading that, I was like, there are some strange parallels to what are happening within the domestic scenario. Like there is deflation. Like RBI has been decreasing interest rates now for successive quarters.
Yeah.
And I mean, I won't say there's deflation, but there's
lack of inflation.
Lack of inflation, yeah. Right? And I think in the Indian context, it's probably not because of being over leveraged, is probably because of consumption drop.
Yeah.
Right? So I guess in if you look at the debt deflation parallel in our kind of framework, it's like drop in consumption, hence reduction of prices, hence deflation, hence, you know, assets go down. When assets go down, overnight you become over leveraged, right?
Yeah.
And due to that, the credit just gets killed.
Yeah.
And it stays like that.
So what's the solution?
I think then we have to go to another economist to kind of, you know, take a pick from there.
Mm-hmm.
Because I guess what Fisher was trying to say was that when debt deflation hits, monetary policy is no longer a fix. So you have to look at the fiscal route.
Okay.
That's where Mr. John Maynard Keynes came in. So he said, like, government has to increase the spending because,
because
demand has dropped. So someone has to, you know, take it up. And public spending is the way forward.
Yeah, I remember our finance minister talking about buying cars to,
they should buy cars
to jack up some spending.
Yeah.
Sure, I guess that's in terms.
I mean, I know you are not a very personal fan of excessive state intervention.
I'm not at all. Let free markets thrive, I guess, right? But but I do get a sense of what the stimulant can do. So
I think the question is that it's the same thing, right? I mean, when you invest and you are making losses, there will be a time when it will correct itself, right?
Yeah,
for
exactly.
How long can you
bear it?
Yeah, float the boat.
Yeah.
I guess that becomes a question then, right?
That's a hard question, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. But
and free markets are ruthless when it comes to that, right?
I like that.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Yeah.
But talking about sort of government, you know, from a school of thought of government using to spur demand, let's call it.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the big paycheck that RBI has recently cut.
Yeah, I think we had a few podcast episodes dedicated to that a few months back. Then we kind of lost. We thought that, I don't know, whenever it happened. Then it finally happened. 1.76 lakh crore.
Yeah. That is another unicorn, the RBI.
RBI, Another juicy dividend plus some reserve.
High yield stock.
Yeah. I mean, to be fair, I mean, I think that basically the government's hands are tied, right? I mean, they are not collecting. The revenue accruals are weak. GST is not giving out the kind of accruals that they expected. So taxation on a standalone basis is not working out, right? And the second was PSU disinvestment. Now, PSU disinvestment also, they tried to do a few of them, but like, you know, I think the PSUs themselves are so distressed that nobody's ready to buy them.
Yeah.
This was an easy check. And they first changed the leadership, and then ever since that change has happened, things have been relatively okay on that front. So, so there are three big pieces that came in, right? RBI made this big kind of transfer. Second was that there was a big bank merger plan which was announced. And the third has been the FM's economic plan, which was kind of focused on, you know, removing the FPI tax surcharge, which was focused on looking
which is
at
good,
the auto sector. Yeah, the FPI part is good.
Yeah.
But I mean, I do feel that the FPI migration away from India was not just because of the tax surcharge.
Sure, yeah, sure.
It was also because of one of the many factors. The reduced rate differential. Yeah. But yeah, sure. I mean, that's something which was required, right?
Yeah.
So the surcharge is off. GST refunds, they are saying, will kind of be released on time, which should have the working capital of a lot of MSMEs.
Yeah.
And then there was a 70,000 crore PSB injection. But there's no big public spending drive.
No, and in fact, I don't know, even the big check that RBI's cut, what was it, 1.76 lakh crore?
Yeah.
I don't know how much of it will go into bank recapitalization.
I think most of it will go in making sure that the government still hits the 3-3.5% fiscal deficit target.
Yeah.
So I don't think the use of funds is going to be just budgetary.
Yeah.
So the other way for funding enhancement would be to borrow from foreign investors, which I think there has been some start on that front as well.
Yeah, and that sits with what you were talking about earlier of government
trying to
spruce demand, I guess, right?
I don't know if that's the... I mean, that's kind of... When you're kind of in that debt deflation limbo, that's a potential solution, but that brings its own set of problems.
Sure, yeah. And that's how economics is, right? I mean, there is no standardized, templatized solution, I guess.
Yeah.
But I'm okay with running deficits or widening deficits, I mean, to spur demand. Like, I mean, I'm not an economist, but it seems fine.
I mean, the government is probably the best counterparty.
Yeah,
so,
exactly.
I mean, if they don't do it, then who will?
Exactly,
right?
Yeah.
So, but the problem is that, I mean, that way, I think the entire bank consolidation play, I think it's slightly disingenuous because it's being positioned as something which will spike up credit demand. I mean, I don't buy that, there's so much integration and so much, so-called the synergy tapping takes a fair bit of time.
Yeah.
So I guess the bank management will be more concerned with, operationally streamlining and merging rather than actually enhancing their loan book. So I see that as a dead duck. Obviously, they're... Capital situation will get balanced because you have a mediocre bank being merged with, say, a good bank. So you have a slightly, better than average looking bank as a result.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about the mega merger. So what's happening? Like 18 or was it 19 banks? Or
27.
That was last year, correct?
Yeah. So from 27, now you'll have 12.
Now we'll have 12. But in this year, we had 18 or 19?
I don't know.
Okay. So we're going from...
So the last one was, I think, that the Vijaya Bank, Dena Bank, and they kind of Bank of Baroda. That was the merger.
Then before that,
you had SBI taking in all the regional
state
banks. All the regional state banks kind of merged into SBI.
Yeah.
So you had State Bank of Bikaner and Jaipur and all that, right? So they kind of came into that.
So I think from that, we went to 18 and now we've gone to 12.
Now we've gone to 12.
Yeah.
So, I mean, on the face of it, it just looks like a way of shoring up capital. Basically, you have a small balance sheet bank, which has a high NPA ratio, or a small balance sheet bank which has weak capital, and then you have a large balance sheet bank which has a slightly okayish NPA or capital ratio.
You absorb it.
You blend it in. So it's the percentage doesn't look...
The blended average kicks in.
The percentage is a bit high, but not that high. That's, I guess, the rationale. But I feel that considering the operational and governance lapses which are so prevalent in all banks, especially in PSBs, making them bigger, I don't know.
Yeah.
How good
fewer and
be.
Bigger, higher concentration.
I would have still liked, if they would have if all the bad or toxic portfolios which have been, ring fenced into one bad bank of sorts, the kind of approach they took in the UK. But that's not the case here.
No.
I
don't even know what the matching principles are here, in which banks will go together. I don't know. But I like the idea of ring fencing toxic or bad loans and sort of
post 2008 that was the approach that was followed in the UK, right? So the government, the FCA created UKFI, that's United Kingdom Financial Investment. So it was like a SPV or some legal structure which was created to hive off the bad loans of big British banks.
Yeah.
And then you had the hedge funds, Blackstone or whatever, they were coming in and they were kind of turning around those assets. That's what they do, right?
Yeah.
Those structured credit teams in these hedge funds, that's what they're qualified to do, right? Whereas in the Indian context, State Bank of India is hiving off bad loans into itself, which I don't think they are the most technically qualified to execute such deals and identify such opportunities. So it's kind of a more of a state heavy, so the kind of approach that you dislike, the statism, the heavy government intervention approach is going on in the bank consolidation.
Yeah.
Whereas there has been no direct spending drives as such. So it's kind of a bit of a dichotomy.
Yeah. And another puzzling thing for me is, like, and this is all, this is more, I mean, it's not a statistical piece of evidence or anything, it's conjecture, but, like, instead of sort of revitalizing demand or focusing on recovering bad loans, like, all of a sudden, for the next 2-3 years, all these banks will be focused on integration.
Yeah.
Which, it's such a big cost, and sure, it is a massive cost, right? And you're looking at banks with different profiles. That is going to be interesting, because, like, we know that so many mergers fail. And those are mergers which are not forced into,
yeah,
but which on paper look like there is a synergy, there's a cultural match, there is, you do all that, then you identify a target, you acquire, and still,
yeah,
you see structural challenges in post-integration or pro forma way, right?
Yeah.
So here you're being forced into sort of, you know, pairing up with whatever or creating the mini consortiums, if you will. So it's going to be very, it's going to be a challenge. Not that can't be achieved, but it's going to be very interesting to see how they integrate.
Yeah, I mean, I would have rather liked if, you know, they would have done like some sort of a feasibility study and then put all the banks in buckets, which are the good ones, which are the high-performing ones. Don't touch the high-performing ones. Maybe have some sort of interventions to improve the governance so that,
yeah,
you know, future underwriting is solid. And in case of the bad ones, yeah, then you ring-fence the bad loans and then you, you know, have a more structured, segmented approach. But right now, I mean, frankly, I don't know whether there's any strategy which is governing this.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, it's...
Do you have bank accounts with any of those banks?
I do not. I do not. I mean, but I think from a consumer front, it's the best thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And from a consumer front, I mean, they'll be, I mean,
yeah,
I mean, if it's, if a small government bank will get bailed out, a bigger government bank will definitely get bailed out.
Yeah.
So it's, I think consumers shouldn't complain.
Yeah.
I guess, but from a...
But it will be so catastrophic if we ever see some... If a bailout is required,
yeah,
if our banks go rogue completely. I mean...
The risk is definitely being
higher,
more concentrated,
yeah,
right? I mean, now you have... So earlier you had a mix of public and private sector banks in the top 5 or top 10 categories when it comes to size of loan book,
yeah,
or market cap. Now you'll have a lot more state-driven players there.
Yeah.
And yeah, you'll have... maybe in the next 2-3 years, everything is fine. But in like 5-10 years, say there's another kind of a governance lapse as we saw in like Nirav Modi scam, but
yeah,
you know, in one of these bigger banks.
Yeah.
I mean, the consequences are also going to be, much more significant.
Yeah. And things like that have also had a big... say in slowing lending as well, I guess, right? I mean,
yeah,
there are just so many more checks and balances now,
yeah,
that it would have eventually happened. The moment you tighten your checklist, you will see some tightening in terms of lending, I guess, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, this movie has played in the West.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
You have seen bank consolidation, you have seen, you know, universal banks, which are doing,
yeah,
everything. Then everybody realized, oh, screw it, they are very conflicted.
Yeah.
Then you had, you know, ring fencing, you had Chinese wall, you had separation. I mean, I remember Goldman Sachs used to be a big publicly,
yeah,
listed universal bank,
yeah,
then it got kind of, you know, then it was delisted, then, you know, you had clear demarcation. So, I mean, these things have kind of gone in cycles everywhere else.
Yeah.
I have a feeling it's going to go in the same trajectory here.
Yeah, yeah.
But, yeah, it was a quick fix.
Yeah.
So,
let's see how things unfold, though.
Yes, that is...
Maybe,
I think,
lending will be revived.
Maybe, yes, yes, maybe. Unfortunately, I mean, I only wish if bankers would lend if they were told to lend.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it has happened before, but that led to NPAs.
Maybe. Yeah, I guess so.
So,
after a period of...
So, good lending doesn't happen when you're told to lend.
Exactly.
Yeah. Bad lending can happen. So,
But yeah, let's see how the things go. But I really like what you talked about, government to sort of catalyze spending.
Yeah.
So I don't know whether we'll see some big CapEx type projects, or will you see some, you know, spurring. Like, I'm curious to see how that plays out.
I mean, even recently, wasn't there some piece that we saw in, I think it was in Mint, where they were saying that the unit economics of road building is also now off.
Okay.
So, I mean, in those kind of situations, who can take the,
yeah,
you know, it has to be the government, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I won't, maybe some more statues, who knows? You know, that's a stimulant.
That would not please me at all.
Huh?
That would not please me at all.
A few more statues, a bit more,
yeah,
a few more bridges.
Yeah. That will please me.
That is okay, right?
Yeah. I mean, unless it's just not functional for anything,
yeah,
but just...
A few bullet trains.
That would also be fine, yeah.
That is okay, I guess.
I guess,
right.
Yeah.
Right. I don't know whether on a slightly amused slash cynical look, I think this is a good way to end today's podcast. I think we touched upon a lot of things without, as usual, making any...
bantering
banter,
around.
As I said, it starts with the banter, it ends on that. And with that, I would like to wish everyone a nice week. And this is Nikhil Arora.
This is Sharad Tupran.
Signing off.